Hartman program. Tom Hartman. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Well, it's Friday, Shabbat Shalom, TGIF, Juma Mubarak, and however else you say it in all the major religions of the world. Happy weekend. And, of course, if it's Friday here on the Tom Hartman radio program, as it has been for years and years, it is Brunch with Bernie in our first hour. Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov, his website, and the independent senator from Vermont. I think of him as America's senator. And Senator Bernie Sanders, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Hey, Bernie, I've got some incredible news for you. The winter ratings books are coming out, and where they rank radio stations and individual programs. And we were just here in Portland able to dig down into the numbers on an hour-by-hour basis and comparing radio stations to radio stations. And oddly, I broadcast here from a group of five stations that are all owned by Clear Channel. And we're on KPOJ, which is the progressive station, 25,000-watt station. Rush Limbaugh, who I am opposite, I've been opposite Rush Limbaugh for 6 years now. Rush Limbaugh is on KEX, which is the big conservative station in town. They're both owned by the same company. In fact, it all comes out of the same building here. I beat Limbaugh. Beat Limbaugh in this book. And a year ago, I beat the Limbaugh in Seattle. I mean, this is the second time, I think the third book now, that I've beat Limbaugh in a different city. And so anybody who says progressive talk radio can't be successful, and people say, oh, it's Portland. Well, our metro area, there are five counties in our metro area. Three of them in the last two elections voted for George W. Bush. So this is, not a liberal paradise. So there is, a downtown Portland, is fairly liberal, but the larger listening area, no, this is very reflective of America.
Just, a lot of that goes to your hard work and your intelligence and how well you do radio. But also, I think it speaks to the fact that people are hungering on talk radio for a different point of view than right-wing extremism. And one of the issues that bothers me immensely when we talk about corporate control over the media, whether it is television or newspapers or whatever it may be, is especially on radio, where right-wing extremism, some really crazy, off-the-wall people who are sexist, who are racist, I mean, just really crazy folks, they're all over the place. And yet you have a hunger in America, which we see every single day in the polling, where people want to move this country in a very different direction than Bush has taken us, and yet it is so hard in major communities all over America to get progressive radio. So congratulations to you, and let's just hope we can expand what you are doing and what other progressive talk shows are doing, because I think that's very much what the American people want to hear.
Well, thank you. This is something, it has happened in variations. I mean, I beat Limbaugh. I've beat Bill O'Reilly in a whole lot of markets over the years. Randy Rhodes for years was beating Rush Limbaugh down in Florida, probably still is. Ed Schultz has beat Sean Hannity in a number of markets. I mean, there's a lot of progressives who have done this, and I've been doing it for years, and we're seeing the growth and the numbers, and it's just a matter of give us a stick, give us a signal, put us on the air, and
exactly.
We'll show you we can get ratings.
What these ratings are about is a manifestation, I think, of the disgust of the American people to the right-wing extremism that we're seeing from the White House, that we have seen from the Republican control of the Congress for so many years.
Yeah.
And people know that there are profound problems in our country and that right-wing extremism is not going to solve those problems. They want to hear an alternative point of view. They want to hear intelligent radio. They want to hear different points of view. And that's what you are doing, and that's what other progressive talk show hosts are doing. And we just got to keep pushing that envelope and get the word out as best we can.
Yeah. Amen. So gas prices and Barack Obama. I wanted to talk about these two things with you, Bernie. First of all, I know I lived in Vermont for 10 years, and I grew up in Michigan, which is a largely very rural state. I lived in New Hampshire for 10 years. The working people, particularly in those states in America where there is not a good public transportation infrastructure, are really getting whacked.
They sure are. And I think when we talk about the energy crisis, Tom, we have to look at it at two ways. We have an immediate crisis today, and that is that you have millions of working people, certainly in a rural state like the state of Vermont, who are traveling long distances to work. It is certainly not uncommon in this state or any place in rural America for people to travel 50 miles to their job and 50 miles back. And if those people are making $10 an hour, $12 an hour, $15 an hour, you know what? Any wage increase that they might have gotten is going right into that gas tank. I have received hundreds and hundreds of emails from Vermonters who are talking about the horrendous impact that these gas and oil price increases are having them on them, not only at the gas pump but trying to heat their homes. We had an email from a family, husband and wife, both working. They did not have enough money to heat their home in the wintertime. The result is their kid got sick. And I don't think this is all that unusual. Older people now literally having to cut wood because they can't afford oil anymore. So I think when you look at the energy situation today, some people are saying, well, all we have to do is focus on, you know, solving and lowering oil prices today. Well, no. And some people are saying, well, all we have to do is worry about transforming our energy system, moving to energy efficiency and to sustainable energy. Well, no. You have to go down both paths. You have to be cognizant of the fact that today tens of millions of people are being hit right over the head with a 2x4. Because of these outrageously high gas and oil prices, it has to be dealt with. What does that mean? It means, in my view, and I'm happy to say working with some others in the Senate, we're beginning to move forward on a package. It means, among other things, a windfall profits tax on the oil companies who have been making outrageous profits in recent years. A fellow who's head of Occidental Oil last year, in 2006, received $400 million in compensation. A little bit before that, the fellow who was head of ExxonMobil received, I think, $390-some-odd million as a retirement package. Their profits are, ExxonMobil has more profits than any corporation in the history of the world. Yeah, we have to have a windfall profits tax on them. We have to deal with the issue of speculation, which is driving up oil prices very substantially. We have to deal with the issue of not putting more oil into the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which could drive oil prices down. And by the way, Tom, I believe that on Tuesday, that particular issue is going to be coming right before the Senate for a vote, and I think we stand a good chance to win it.
Interesting. That's great.
And the point here is this has been done before. Clinton did it. Bush the first did it.
Jimmy Carter really took this on. This was huge. Jimmy Carter was – there are homes all over Vermont. In fact, our best friends who still live in Vermont are living in one that were built in the late 70s as a result of all the tax credits that Carter put on to build energy-efficient solar houses.
I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the strategic
– Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. I just meant generally the whole – yeah, I don't know what Carter did with the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. I'm sorry.
But then in addition to all of these short-term things, which we have to do, we also have to we are making some progress on moving this country away from our dependence on foreign oil, our dependence on fossil fuel in general, move toward energy efficiency and sustainable energy. What I just want to say is I believe personally, and I'm on both the Energy Committee and the Environmental Committee, know a little bit about this, there is huge, unbelievable potential. We can do it as a nation. We can break out dependency on fossil fuel, and in the process, create millions of good-paying jobs. Think about America having a rail system the equivalent of Europe or Japan. Think about our people driving plug-in hybrids, which get very, very good mileage per gallon. Think about our people driving electric cars, which have a range of 200 or 300 miles. Think about light bulbs that last 10 times longer than the incandescents that many people use today. Think about dozens of solar thermal unit plants in the southwest in this country, in California, Nevada, New Mexico, where millions and millions of people are getting their electricity from these solar plants. All of these things are not science fiction. They're sitting there ready to happen. And what we need right now in Washington is the political will to move in that direction. Obviously, with Bush in the White House, that's not going to happen. But with a Democratic president, I think we can make just huge steps forward in transforming our energy system. So my point of view is it's not either or. You have to deal with the crisis today because a lot of people are hurting very badly. But long term, we have to transform our energy system.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is Carter took this on.
Right.
Here's 1979.
What I have to say to you now about energy is simple and vitally important. Point one, I am tonight setting a clear goal for the energy policy of the United States. Beginning this moment, this nation will never use more foreign oil than we did in 1977. Never.
And, you know, had Reagan not become elected and repealed his legislation, that would be the case.
Yeah. And then that has just foreign policy implications of enormous consequences.
Yeah, absolutely. It has led right to a whole series of disasters in the Middle East. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Brunch with Bernie. 866-303-2270. Our telephone number for your calls for Senator Sanders. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
Friday, although we are in the second hour, going to be talking with Medea Benjamin, who is, this is a Mother's Day special. She is traveling around the United States with an Iraqi refugee whose husband and four-year-old daughter were killed by the militias because he was an interpreter for the U.S., and how we are failing to defend our allies, our friends in that region, and what's going on in Iraq. And in our third hour, Congressman Rush Holt is going to drop by. So it's going to be a busy day, but we'll also be taking your calls throughout the day. And, of course, this hour, Brunch with Bernie, Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov for Bernie's website, his great newsletter, and our number, 866-303-2270, tomhartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room, airamerica.com for all things Air American associated with us and our program. And, Bernie, shall we pick up some phone calls?
Let's do it.
Okay, Carol in Mesa, Arizona, listening on KPHX. Hey, Carol.
Good morning, Senator Sanders. On the housing mortgage bailout, the developers, they shouldn't be part of that mortgage meltdown bailout. They've made huge profits, especially out here. I know they have a lot more lobbyists than this little guys, and that's how the money probably got in there in the first place. But I would like to see the help go to people that could still keep their homes at the initial interest rate. Is there any chance that the developers could be dropped in the conference committee to reconcile the House and Senate bills?
Well, Carol, thank you very much for that question. It sounds like you know a little bit about how Congress works. The simple truth is the bill that passed the Senate, a bill which I voted for, was not a particularly good bill, and everybody acknowledged that. It had, among other things, a lot of help, as Carol indicates, for the home builders and tax breaks that went back over a few years. And as Carol also quite rightly points out, the reason is the home builders have a very powerful lobby in Washington, D.C., contribute a lot of money. We could not have gotten any bill through the Senate because the Republicans would have filibustered it, as they do time and time and time again, unless we made those concessions. But I voted for it precisely because, as Carol indicates, in the House there is a lot stronger bill. There is a better bill in the House, and we will see what happens in conference committee. But I hope that we do exactly as Carol indicated, and that is provide assistance for people who are desperately trying to keep their homes, rather than give tax breaks to home builders who just don't need them.
Okay. Anne in New Mexico, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders. Hey,
yes.
Anne.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Bernie. I'm a truck driver. I listen to you on XM. I was wondering if, number one, you were going to support the Truck Act, and number two, I just heard that private jets have been assessed a fuel tax surcharge. Truck drivers pay not only exorbitant fuel taxes, but we also pay road taxes. And I was wondering if there's any proposal to start charging at least road taxes to these private land yachts. They're like 53 to 60 foot RVs that are all over the country using the roads but not paying for them.
Well, Ann, you raise some good questions, and I'm not as familiar as I should be with these issues. What I do know is the infrastructure in this country is, believe me, in Vermont and all over this country, in very serious trouble. We need over $1 trillion to rebuild the infrastructure. And we have got to figure out a way to make those people who are causing the damage, and some of these are very, very large vehicles who do infinitely more damage to roads than automobiles do, pay their fair share of the process. And at the same time, we have also figure out a way to maintain the trucking industry, all of which is not so easy. But those are the dynamics. But I can't give you a better answer than that, Ann. I'm sorry.
Myron in Miami, Florida, listening on WINS. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Thank you so much. I feel honored to talk to both you, two outstanding Americans at one shot. I was wondering if anything is being done to reel in this corporate takeover of American lifestyle. Our whole country has been changed and transformed in order to generate more money for these corporations, whether it's through our mother and fathers both having to work. I'm a single guy. I have my own business, and it's extremely difficult for me. I don't know how people are making it. But there seems to be ignoring of antitrust laws, that laws that are on the books are ignored so that corporations can now own everything, and this
yes.
has got to stop.
Okay, Myron, you make a very good point, and it's an issue, obviously, that Tom and I talk about almost every week. In my view, what has not gotten, for obvious reasons, the kind of attention that it deserves is the class warfare that has been waged in this country for the last 30 or 40 years. And by that I mean just a horrendous assault on the middle class and on working families and on lower income people, the result of which is that there has been a huge transference of wealth from the middle class to the very, very rich. Corporations make out like bandits, and working people are not surviving. So we can talk a little bit more about this, but Myron is absolutely right. That is the issue of the day.
We need another Teddy Roosevelt. Bust up the trusts, even though he was a Republican. Bernie Sanders with us. Sanders.Senate.gov is website. It's the Tom Hartman Program, our Brunch with Bernie Hour here on Air America Radio.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
866-302-2270. Back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Yes, where we beat Rush Limbaugh in the ratings. Oh, my. Roy in Long Island, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie Hour here. Roy, and thanks for listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. You're up with Bernie.
Hi there. I was wondering if the Uniting Families Act is ever going to pass this year, and if not, why?
I'm sorry, which act?
The Uniting Families Act, it's for binational gay couples to bring their spouses into the United States like straight people can do.
Okay, well, that sounds reasonable. I can't give you a definitive answer on that. It makes sense to me.
Okay. So thank you, Roy, for bringing it up, and you'll check into it, Bernie?
We can check into it, yeah.
Okay.
Sometimes, Tom, what people should know, there are literally thousands of pieces of legislation out there, and it's hard to keep track of all of them.
Right, and I know each senator, depending on what committees they're on,
right.
tend to
be more or less familiar with
their focus in different areas.
Right.
Yeah, David in Seattle, Washington, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hey, good morning, you guys. Speaking of gas tax gimmicks, the story I read on Buzzflash or Democratic Underground a couple days ago about diesel fuel to the tune of almost a billion, either a million gallons or a million barrels, maybe you guys know this, was sent to Mexico prior to the price of diesel, shooting up to $4.50 a gallon, which I pay up here in Washington. There hasn't been any follow-up, and my second question is, why hasn't Congress passed any strong legislation banning computerized voting machines across all 50 states?
Congress is, in fact, and I know you're going to have Rush Holt on your next hour, and Rush has been very active in that. What states are doing in terms of these digital voting machines are taking increasingly strong actions, and I think a number of states now have, in fact, banned them. Tom, would remind me, that's Florida, I think, has done that? And
yeah, Charlie Crist down in Florida did. There's been a lot of pushback in California. There are a number of other states that are looking at this. It seems more often than not that they're just saying, hey, let's have a paper trail. I think there are six states now where in this election there won't even be a paper trail. It's going to be entirely invisible. No ability to recount or anything.
Well, I mean, that's certainly a dangerous trend. In terms of diesel, it's not just diesel. I think we have a crisis which impacts truck drivers who often use diesel, but the average driver, and we are working on a multi-prong program which includes a windfall profits tax, which includes taking, stopping, putting oil into the strategic petroleum reserve, which deals with speculation, and which also deals with an issue of OPEC and the oil cartel, which in many ways functions to limit the production of oil.
Yeah, I think what he was, I'm not totally familiar with the story that he referenced, but I believe that it was, you know, basically what we're seeing with oil right now is Enron all over again, and in part because of the deregulation of commodities markets in 2000.
No, that is absolutely true, and that is an issue that has got to be dealt with.
Yeah, okay. David in Oakland, California, listening on Green 960. David, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
I'm sorry, is that me?
That's you.
Oh, hi. Bernie, I'm a self-published author, illustrator of children's picture books, and I struggle for years against the corporate publishing and bookstore monopolies, and I'm concerned about this Sean Bentley Orphan Works Act that reverses 35 years of copyright law, creates like a loophole for businesses study steal works from independents like myself. I'd like to know what your position on that is.
Well, David, you raise a very important issue. And this, especially in publishing, what you're seeing now is, as best as I can understand, I'm not in the business, is fewer and fewer bookstores and fewer, the Borders and the others, and fewer publishing companies, which make it harder for the little guy to get his book or his product onto the market. And we're looking at copyright law, which is increasingly dominated by big money interests who want to hold on to their copyrights. And it's not only, obviously, in book publishing. You're seeing it an enormous fight taking place in the area of prescription drugs as to how long these pharmaceutical industries can keep their copyright before that medicine becomes generic at a far lower price. And as we heard earlier in the show, this is just the simple manifestation of the power of big money working to maximize their own profits against the needs of ordinary people. You know, people who come up with a creative idea, an intellectual idea, have the right to make money from it. But there is a certain point where that idea goes into the public, and that's what the struggle is about.
Yeah. Linda in Ohio, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Today I would like to address the tyranny of the minority. And
you mean in the Senate?
In the Senate, yes. The state of California has 34 million people, and they have two senators. 12 of the smallest states have 33 million people, and they have 24 senators, 23 of which are Republican. Now, this systemic disparity is allowing the minority to veto the will of the majority as far as setting the agenda, setting priorities, confirming justices to the Supreme Court, and vetoing SCHIP and housing aid, for example. The smaller states have very different concerns and needs than the larger states. And there has to be some way to overturn this tyranny of the minority.
Well, you know, as somebody who comes from one of the smallest states in America, let me respectfully disagree with you in the sense this, the composition of the House and the Senate obviously were based on compromises made in creating the United States of America. But also in terms of the needs of people in smaller states, rural states, as opposed to larger states like California. Frankly, in all due respect, I'm not so sure that there are huge differences. People in California need a national health care program. So do the people in the state of Vermont. People in California have got are concerned about the high cost of energy. So are the people in the state of Vermont, education, global warming, cutting military spending. I think there is a lot more that we have in common than that separate us. Obviously, in large urban areas, there are problems that don't exist in low-population rural areas. But I think we should focus on those areas that, that unite us. In terms of the politics, that in many rural areas, you have more conservative people. I don't think that that's because they're rural. Vermont is a rural state. We have three people in the United States Congress, two in the Senate, one in the House. None of them is anywhere close to being conservative. And I think that's a political issue that has got to be fought out in rural areas where, by the way, people are hurting very, very badly in some cases. You're seeing depopulation, people having very serious access to health care problems, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the solution is to make sure that in rural states in this country, we bring forth a progressive agenda, and we have progressive candidates fighting hard to win.
Yeah, and we see that working. I was just in Missoula, Montana, where we're on the air, and the both the governor, Governor Schweitzer,
the governor and two senators,
right,
are,
and one of the senators dropped by the studio to talk with us, and
they're
very progressive.
That's right, and it's certainly true in North Dakota, where you have two progressive senators there as well. So I don't concede, and by the way, I don't concede that the South has got to be conservative. Mm-hmm. I think what you need is people talking the real issues impacting Americans. There's no state in the country which is not facing a health care crisis, no state in this country where the middle class is not shrinking and population and poverty is not increasing. But what you need is candidates prepared to stand up to big money interests to fight for working people. And when they do that, I think they're going to have political success.
Yeah, and I'd like to see leadership in the Senate, if I may lobby for it, that will stand up to Republican attempts to filibuster anything. That,
well, that's, you know. In fact, I thought when Linda was talking about the tyranny of the minority, I thought that's what she was referring to. And what that is about, and I think everybody should know that. People think, well, you got 100 senators, 51 votes wins. Wrong, wrong, wrong. In the Senate right now, the Republicans have filibustered more than any time, as I understand it, in the history of our country. I think we're well over 65 filibusters. That means an important bill is brought up. And what the Republicans are saying, hey, we want to talk about this forever. That's a filibuster. And we don't have the 60 votes for cloture to end debate to actually vote on the bill. That has to do with tax credits for sustainable energy. That has to do with the S-CHIP program. That has to do with the war in Iraq, global warming, and so forth and so on. You name the issue. If it's an important issue, tax policy, the Republicans are prepared to filibuster. And,
yeah.
Many
of us, though, are wishing that Harry Reid would say, okay, you know, get out the bottle and the tube like Strom Thurmond used to do and prepare to stand there for the next 16 hours if you're gonna filibuster.
I think that is exactly right.
Yeah, and it's just, well, anyway, don't get me started. Trucker in Port Orchard, Washington. We've got a minute before the break. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders, Trucker.
Okay, well, I'll be as fast as I can. The windfall profit tax needs to be coupled with an instant rebate program designed around the same kind of guidelines as the stimulus package was, in which the taxes come in and they go right back out the other side.
That's right.
To help the people that need to get the gas to go to work.
No, that what we're struggling with, I mean, and that's where people are making fun of the tax holiday, which is not a bad idea, because that's pretty instant. Your prices go down at the pump. There are problems with that. The problems with getting a rebate back is it costs a lot of money to administer, and nothing in Washington turns around as quickly. So you're absolutely right in saying that the money has raised. They've got to go back to the people who are paying these outrageous prices at the pump, and we're struggling for the best mechanism to do that.
Yeah, and the liberal perspective of saying, no, it's got to be perfect ain't good enough.
That's right.
We need to do something in the short term as well as the long term. 45 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman radio program on Air America. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Brunch with Bernie. Sanders.Senate.gov, his website.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
of a new America. Going back to the core values that this country was founded on. Excuse me, the progressive values of democracy and the we the people. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Our Brunch with Bernie Hour, sanders.senate.gov is website. Our toll-free number, 866-303-2270, all across the United States and from most countries around the world. And tomhartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. And Tom in Cincinnati, Ohio, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Oh, hi, Bernie. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Tom.
My subject concerns the combustible engines. And I think Tom has touched on this subject before on one of his shows. Why don't we do a Manhattan Project on the combustible engines? And I think within 6 months to a year, we can have an engine built that does 60 miles a gallon.
Well, Tom, I think you're right. And the idea of a Manhattan-type project, not just for combustible engine, but I think for energy in general. I think, and this is very, very good news, that we already know how to transform our energy system in transportation, electricity, and in many other areas. Obviously, we need to pump large sums of money into research and development, get our engineers working on this stuff. But I think there are already prototypes out there. I drove myself a retrofitted Toyota Prius that was developed by a fellow at MIT, which got, it was a prototype, which got 150 miles per gallon. I've been in electric cars. This stuff is sitting out there, and we do need to invest in it. We can create jobs in the process, and we can transform America's energy system. But Tom is exactly right. We need, instead of investing in nuclear power, instead of certainly investing in the war in Iraq at $12 billion a month, we need a Manhattan-style project for sustainable energy and for energy efficiency.
Todd in Todd in Hillsboro, Oregon, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Todd, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hello, gentlemen.
How are you, Todd?
I much appreciate having you on the air. You provide a very nice way to get some good information out. Basic question I have is, first off, it seems that much of the difficulties we have with our system right now is because our form of government is designed to give everyone a forum and try to find a way to balance interest and needs.
Say that again. I didn't quite hear that, Todd.
I'm sorry. Say that again, please.
Yeah, Todd, Bernie's having a hard time hearing you on your cell phone there. It's pretty noisy. Can you just put the question together really fast and short, and maybe I can repeat it if necessary.
Right. Okay. Here it is very quickly. Our government is designed to balance the needs and interests of individuals. But because of the rapid growth of corporations and their position basically that since they're not an individual, money is equated to being their voice.
Right.
Can we not get a bill passed in Congress to explicitly define corporations as not persons and therefore the freedoms of speech equating money do not apply?
Well, I think, Tom, you wrote a book on that subject, didn't you?
I did, on equal protection, yeah. In fact, Ralph Nader was quoting it yesterday.
Todd, the $64 issue in Washington, of course, is power. And you're absolutely right in saying that in every area you think about, whether it is energy and the high cost of gas and oil, the fact that we don't have a national health insurance program while insurance companies make huge profits, the fact that our people are paying 25% on interest rates on their credit cards, the fact that we have a military-industrial complex, which is virtually unregulated, making huge profits, et cetera, has to do with the power of big money in Washington. And that is the issue that we have to deal with. And I think my immediate concern is creating a Congress that has the courage to fight for public funding of elections so that candidates are not dependent on this type of money, deal with antitrust legislation, deal with trade legislation, which demands that corporate America start reinvesting in this country. Once again, trying to create a level playing field where ordinary people's needs and concerns are addressed by Congress rather than just the very, very powerful in the corporate world.
Right. Just to put a punctuation mark on that, here's one sentence from the Berkshire Hathaway annual report. Corporate taxes are at the lowest level since 1934, representing 7.4% of all federal tax receipts, down from 32% of all federal tax receipts in 1952.
Right.
And that's probably Warren Buffett talking.
Yeah, and who's picking up the slack? Right. Not the corporations, well, it's you and me, it's the taxpayers.
Tax policies, well, you name the area. Just take a look out at one's life, whatever it is, whether it's taxes or energy or health care or whatever it may be, interest rates. The large big money interests are making out like bandits. Ordinary people are hurting. And that is precisely what the struggle is. And by the way, getting back to the very first point that we discussed today, and that is corporate media and right-wing media. Do you think right-wing media is going to be talking about corporate power? No.
No.
They will not be talking about it.
No, absolutely not. Rick in Texas, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders. Hey, Rick. We have about a minute here.
I was wondering, why isn't some of the profits that Iraq is making from the oil being used to fund the war? And why are Americans carrying the whole burden?
Well, that's a very good question, and some of us would, A, like to bring the troops back home immediately and end this war, which is costing us $12 billion a month. The other point that Rick makes is that the Iraq now has a significant surplus. I believe it's something like $50 billion. We have a $9 trillion national debt, and many of us think that the Iraqi people should pay for their infrastructural needs for the cost of the war, rather than American taxpayers who are going deeper and deeper into debt.
Yeah. Bernie, we have about 20, 30 seconds here just to wrap up this hour. What do you see coming up in the Senate this week?
Well, as I said, we're going to see more attention paid to the energy crisis on Tuesday. I believe there will be a vote in the Senate on stopping oil from going into the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. I think we have support. This is one instance where a number of Republicans, I think, will work with us. It begins the process of trying to lower the price of gas at the pump.
Great, great. Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov is his website. And Bernie, thanks so much for being
here. Good to be with you, Tom. Thank you.
Always great talking with you. And coming up next, Medea Benjamin is going to drop by. It's Mother's Day this weekend, and we're going to be talking about mothers all over the world. Stick around. It's the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Where smart people get their news. The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. And Medea Benjamin, the co-founder of Code Pink, co-founder of Global Exchange. Their website's globalexchange.org. And Medea, I thought it was codepink.org, but it's something else, is it not?
It's codepinkalert.org.
Alert.org. Thank you very much. I have it written down here wrong, and I remember that there. Codepinkalert.com. And we have a little bit of an alert here. Yes, this from Fox News. Code Pink protesters try witchcraft at anti-war rallies. Code Pink is now resorting to witchcraft. The women's anti-war group has told ralliers to come equipped with spells and pointy hats. Medea, what's going on?
Well, Tom, we've tried everything else, so why not try a little witchcraft?
There you go. Well, I congratulate you on political theater. I mean, it's just, you know, Fox News is all in a snit about it. This is over on Drudge. You've got conservatives all over the country going, oh, my God, it's
But well, let me tell you something, Tom, though. It's indicative. We've been working for the last 2 weeks on this issue of refugees in Iraq. Mm. I just came back from Jordan and Syria. We brought an Iraqi refugee to D.C. with a terrible story to tell. We had Amnesty International. We had other Iraqi experts. And we've been putting this out to the press. We got zero press from the U.S., except for you and a couple other radio stations. And yet when we do the zany kooky stuff, like the bringing the witchcraft to the Marine Recruiting Center, they're all over it, and they can't get enough interviews. So, you know, they want us to look silly, and when we're serious, they don't bother paying attention.
Well, and in a way, it's a tragic commentary on the state of infotainment today, what used to be called news, and well, they still call it news, but what used to actually be news and is now infotainment. And it's all about spectacle, and it's all about, well, But you know, on the other hand, it's great that you've learned how to play that game, as it were, and still get your message out. I mean, Code Pink, everywhere I go, there's Code Pink. It seems like everywhere I go, I see you too. We were at the Green Festival. What city was that? Seattle? A couple weeks ago, I saw you, and I'll be at the Green Festival in Chicago the weekend after this. Again, speaking from the main stage, I'm not sure if you're going to be there, but I'm sure Code Pink will be.
Yes, I will be there, and we do keep ourselves busy. Just in the last couple of days, we were yesterday at the fundraiser for Hillary Clinton, and we were very upset with her obliterate Iran message, so we got inside her fundraiser by literally just walking in, which is quite amazing, and holding up a big banner, obliterate Iran with a question mark, apologize, and got right up close to Hillary Clinton with that message. And we're on the Hill every single day now with this funding of another $160+ billion. We took a rolling bed yesterday out to the Capitol, and we had Nancy Pelosi with a big mask of her in bed with George Bush, and rolling around in the dough and the blood, saying these two are collaborating to keep the war going. So we're visible, and we're out there every day.
It is really time for a change in America. And you know, I remember back in the 60s, you know, from the Smothers Brothers to the more, you know, to the yuppies, to the more no, it wasn't yuppies, it was yippies. What was Jerry Rubin's? Anyhow, there was
yippies,
the yippies.
Not yuppies.
Yeah, there you go. A bunch of groups who were doing political theater, and I mean, that's what it takes sometimes to really punch through and get a message out. And you're doing a great job with it. Tell us about this woman that you brought back from Iraq. This Mother's Day is day after tomorrow, and I think that this is a great tie together here.
Well, this is a woman who worked for the U.S. government. And what is so terribly, tragically ironic is the very people who welcomed the U.S. invasion and went to work with the U.S. forces, in her case, working on their democracy program, and reaching out to women in Iraq to, quote, teach them democracy. When these people get targeted by the Iraqi insurgents for working with the U.S., they then are not welcomed by the United States. So we have two women. We have a woman who we've been working with, who has not been able to come into the United States, but has been a target of many threats because of working as an interpreter. And we have a woman here whose husband worked for the U.S., and because of that, he was targeted. Her husband and her four-year-old daughter, who was driving in the car, both of them were shot and killed. And this woman came here with her only surviving son.
Now, we're speaking with Medea Benjamin, the co-founder of Code Pink, CodePinkAlert.org and GlobalExchange.org. And Medea, my understanding is that the United States has taken in fewer than 5,000 or in the neighborhood of 5,000 Iraqi refugees, yet we have created, you know, I was in Darfur a couple months ago. That is, I think, broadly acknowledged to be the world's largest refugee crisis, the second largest refugee crisis in the world. And frankly, I think it may be the first. Iraq, we have, you were in Syria and Jordan. I've been reading newspaper reports. I've not been in that region. But I've been reading newspaper reports about, for example, that Syria now has become the sex capital of the Middle East. People drive there from Saudi Arabia regularly, that girls as young as 10 and 12 years old are working in brothels in Syria, Iraqi girls, because there's just no other way to make a living.
Well, that's right. And when I was there, I did go into one of these clubs, and it's just so sad to see these young girls dancing up on the stage and the men eyeing them to see which girl they want to sleep with that night.
Yeah.
The Iraqis really have been reduced to a desperate situation when they're living in places like Syria and Jordan. They have no income. They're not allowed to work legally, Tom, because they're not there legally. They're undocumented, quote, guests.
Right.
So how are they supposed to survive? The U.S. has created what is now the largest refugee crisis. It is larger than Darfur.
Yeah.
2 million internally displaced, 1.2 million in Syria, 500,000 in Jordan, and then tens of thousands in Lebanon and Egypt, spread all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the U.S., as you say, has taken less than 5,000 of these refugees in that we have created.
Right. We have a horrible responsibility. I mean, it's just what has been done in our name. What can the average person do? Here's Mother's Day. Is there a Mother's Day gift that can be given in somebody's name? Is codepinkalert.org?
Exactly, yes.
Are you doing anything like that? Are there any good fundraisers, good organizations, agencies out there? What are your suggestions?
Yes, we have looked around, and that was the reason for my trip, is to find organizations that we could work with. And we found a wonderful group. It's called the Collateral Repair Project, play off on the term of collateral damage.
Mm-hmm.
And they work with women to help them find create their own very small income-generating projects, oftentimes in their own homes, baking sweets, sewing clothing, doing some kind of beauty salon or
craft. This is sort of like the Grameen Bank
exactly,
approach, the microcredit.
Exactly, micro kind of thing,
yeah.
As well as helping the poorest women who literally need things like food and clothing. So if people go to our website, codepinkalert.org, you can read more about it and make a donation in your mother's name, in some other mother's name. I just made my own donation in my own name because I wanted to celebrate Mother's Day myself by giving to these Iraqi women.
Yeah, it's just we have destroyed so many families. I mean, here, Mother's Day in America, this kind of greeting card holiday, isn't everything wonderful? And, you know, I mean, obviously I've sent something to my mom and we'll be celebrating this weekend with my wife Louise and our kids. But it's like we can't forget what we are complicit in, what we are doing around the world. And the mothers, I mean, literally the mothers who are, and the children of the mothers and the husbands of the mothers, who are being destroyed in our name in the Middle East.
Well,
and now,
right.
and John McCain talking about going after Iran.
Right. The majority of the refugees are women and children. The majority of people that I met had suffered some kind of terrible loss, either the loss of a husband, the loss of a child, and some of it was at the hands of U.S. soldiers or militias or al-Qaeda or you name it, but we unleashed this whole thing.
Right. Yeah, George Bush opened the gates of hell in the Middle East.
And, that's right.
And we need to do some repair work. Medea Benjamin, you are doing wonderful work. CodePinkAlert.org and, of course, GlobalExchange.org. Thank you so much for dropping by.
Thank you, Tom.
Keep up the great work. I look forward to seeing you again. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows, anything goes.
Anything goes Friday.
Good authors
and welcome back, my friend. 21 minutes past the hour, the second hour of our program. Our number 866-303-2270, TomHartman.com. If you'd like to drop into our live chat room where anything goes also on Fridays. And John in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Well, hey, Tom. My mind got going when you had Code Pink person on. And I knew Mother's Day is coming up. And you know, in honor of all those people who are working for gender justice in this country, or this world, for that matter, I like to pose a question. Wouldn't the term, and you're big on cracking codes and all, wouldn't the term genderist or genderism be more appropriate, accurate than sexism?
It would be literally more accurate and appropriate because sex, in fact, I, when I was younger, just for fun every now and then, when I'd fill out a form and it would say sex, I'd put yes.
Well, and, yeah,
but you know, because sex is really more of a verb than a noun, and gender is, you know, male or female. But the problem is that I think that most people, you know, the word sex, first of all, is a very potent word. And so sexism, you know, drives into the conscious and the unconscious mind. And well, sexism has a very specific meaning in our culture, even though it's, you know, arguably not literally appropriate.
One comment I wanted to make about the term sex or the idea of sex is that, I mean, you look at, you could look at it jokingly and either way, it implies preference rather than definite situation.
Yeah.
Whether you're a nymphomaniac, you could call yourself a sexist because you like it a lot.
Right.
Or you, whether you
or
have
somebody
a
who's chaste.
Certain sexual preference, whether you want to be gay, homosexual, or lesbian, that's preference. But in terms of a gender, solid situation.
Yeah.
I think in terms of this society that's, as you say, popularized the term sexist, I think the society is wrong.
No, John, literally and technically, I absolutely agree with you. And, you know, in a dictionary sense, what we're really talking about is genderism. But it ain't gonna take on. I mean, it's not gonna be picked up. But you know, at the level of English 101 or English 401, you're absolutely right. Mark, and said, thanks for the call. Mark in Saranac, Michigan. Hey, Mark. Mark, you're on the air.
Oh, hi.
Hey.
Am I on the air?
You are. What's up?
Hey, I don't know if I'm off topic or not. I listen to the show.
There is no topic. It's Friday.
All right, that's right. I forget about that. I get the podcast and I listen the following day, so I'm always a day behind. Hey, I was wondering if maybe the reason that there isn't more prosecution and you know, maybe impeachment going on is that there's a strategy that if charges aren't brought before the end of Bush's term, that he can't really pardon anything. I mean, can he do a blanket pardon, or... He certainly can't pardon anything after he's left office.
Right. And what he can do is he can pardon people proactively on the way out, and I fully expect him to. He can grant pardons for crimes that haven't even been discovered yet.
Wouldn't he have to describe?
No, he wouldn't. No, this is what George Bush Sr. Did with Caspar Weinberger, or maybe it was Ronald Reagan who did it. I don't remember what, one or the other of them. This has been done before. It's Jerry Ford did it with Richard Nixon. He can simply say, Domini, you're all, you know, sacred now or whatever. I mean, you're protected, and just issue a blanket pardon. The thing that can prevent that is an attempted impeachment, and frankly, I think that the Democrats have made a big mistake. This is, you know, just my opinion. They obviously think I'm wrong, but I think that the Democrats have made a big mistake in saying that they're not going to use impeachment as a political strategy, that it will be perceived as a political strategy. I would say, A, it's a constitutional strategy. It's not a political strategy. And B, it could be used in a positive and appropriate way as a political strategy. Eddie in Dallas, you want to correct our caller before last about their, I didn't even catch that reference to gay as a preference. Go ahead.
Yeah. He had said that being gay or lesbian is a preference. No, it's not a preference. We didn't choose to be this way.
Yeah, I can't imagine anybody saying, gee, I think I'll choose to be a persecuted minority who might be murdered for the way I am. I'm not sure if the caller meant that, you know, to be putting out the right-wing spin and talking points, or if it was just a misstatement. But I believe that you're absolutely right. And in fact, there's a fairly large body of science to back up your position as well. And you see homosexuality not just in the human species, but you see it right across all mammalian species and increasingly in other species. We've got, Louise and I, we live on the river here in Portland, and we've got a gay duck couple that has been together for 3 years, these two male ducks. that just, you know, they're together and you know,
last
fall during mating season, they were even getting it on, these two male ducks. So I'm telling you.
I would not have chosen to have been tied to a tree and set on fire.
Yeah, there you go. It's nobody's going to choose that. Eddie, thank you very much for the call and for helping us clean that up. 27 minutes past the hour.
Is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. I've always been crazy. It's kept me from nobody knows if it's something to bless or to blame. Till now, I ain't found a rhyme or a reason to change. I've always been crazy. It's kept me from going insane.
And speaking of crazy, this, as we say, from the wire services, the latest superdelegate defection in what some Democratic Party insiders are calling a particularly ominous sign for Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. Former President Bill Clinton today became the latest superdelegate to switch from Senator Clinton to her rival, Senator Barack Obama. Sources close to the former president say that Mr. Clinton had been mulling such a defection for weeks, as early as the night of the Iowa primary, but that he had only decided to make his decision public today. Mr. Clinton said at a press conference in New York, "The American people want change. Lord knows I do." The former president said that sometimes at the end of the race, you have to put an old horse down, adding, "I'm not speaking metaphorically." Mr. Clinton fueled speculation that he was seeking a role in an Obama administration, saying, "I know my way around the Oval Office, and I know how the super secret double lock works." The former president said he would relish a return to the White House, calling his tenure there good times. For her part, Senator Clinton said that the defection of her husband would not deter her from staying in the race, adding, "To my knowledge, he's the only white voter Senator Obama has." The New York senator denied she was playing the race card, arguing, "Every other member of my family is supporting me, and by the way, they're white." Elsewhere, a defiant John McCain said that his wife will not release her tax returns, quote, "and neither will my girlfriend," end quote. Not from the wire services, no. From Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com. Always with appreciations for Andy's, our crazy alerts from Andy. Francis, listening in Seal Beach, California on KTLK. Yes. Hey, Francis, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, and hello.
Hi.
This has to do with farm subsidies,
mm-hmm.
but not in total. Just one little section that I found out about probably 3 weeks ago and couldn't hardly believe it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember the space shuttle that was entering our atmosphere and disintegrated?
Yeah.
Now, this isn't believable, but it's true. As it passed over Texas, if any pieces fell off in certain counties, you went out and located the pieces, and you were given a farm subsidy. They started at $40,000 and went on up. And I just found that outrageous. And I did not know about that.
A way to pay people for returning? I know that there were some people who were trying to sell pieces of the shuttle on eBay and whatnot, and they were being prosecuted.
Well, what they did, they said it's called damage to your property. Now, I can hardly imagine that anyone's property was damaged, but I thought, considering that these were lives that were lost and people made money on it, of course they've made money on a lot of things, but I thought to call that a farm subsidy was really terrible.
Yeah, that is totally strange. Francis, thanks for the heads up on that. I remember this when that happened, when the spaceship or shuttle Columbia went down. I had been working on a book, which is now out, What Would Jefferson Do? And I had been reading about how the founders, I was going back and reading a lot of original source material. I had this 20-volume collection of the collected writings of Thomas Jefferson, the only time it had ever been published, in 1909. And Jefferson had been talking about the Whig histories And this one particular history of Europe, which was published in 1772, and I bought an original copy of it, and I'm reading literally a book from 1772. I mean, it's a, and then some of the letters that Jefferson and many of the other founders had back and forth. And one of the interesting things that I discovered was that there was a number of them who believed that the United States should have a goddess, that many of the Native American tribes that they were, particularly the Iroquois Confederacy, that they were basing large parts of the Constitution on, and who were senior advisors, shall we say, to people like Ben Franklin and James Madison and Thomas Jefferson. Some of them were animists. Some of them had, well, they respected the goddess. They viewed the earth as a feminine force rather than a masculine force, and or in addition to a masculine force. And they felt that there needed to be balance. And they were also looking at the Greeks, and they were also looking at the Romans. And they said, you know, in Greek and Roman times, there were goddesses as well as gods, particularly the Greeks. And so America should have, there were plenty of gods. I mean, there was the various major religions of the world. And they were all basically male-dominated. And so there was this idea to create a goddess. And they took the name. And you'll see, by the way, she is on the top of the Capitol building. There's a 19.5-foot statue of the goddess of America on top of the U.S. Capitol. And the idea was that she could take many different forms. In fact, there is an image of her in the Justice Department holding the scales with a blindfold on, and that John Ashcroft covered up with a drape. I thought that was ironic that here is John Ashcroft covering up liberty. She was referred to as Lady Liberty in that context, or the goddess of law. In some state capitals, I believe in Vermont where we live, she's on the top of that Capitol building holding, as the goddess of agriculture, holding some wheat, some grains. You see her sometimes holding weapons of war, you know, arrows, sometimes peace. She took many different forms. And they took the name Columbus, the guy who discovered, you know, arguably discovered America, and or was given credit for it anyway, and feminized his name, Columbia, and they named the goddess Columbia. And they wanted to give her a space in the United States that was so sacred that politics as usual couldn't be conducted there, where the people there were essentially dedicated to the goddess and to the ideals of the nation rather than to just ordinary politics. And so the people who lived in that particular place, that sacred place of the goddess, would not even be allowed to be represented in Congress. And they called this place the District of the Goddess Columbia. We refer to it as the District of Columbia. And she was on our coins right up until the 1950s, I think it was. You know, Lady Liberty with a walking liberty. I believe she's on our coins. She might be on our coins again. I'm not sure with the I haven't seen the new gold dollar that the government is publishing. So anyhow, I was reading this story about how the U.S. had created this goddess in the early founding of our nation, and it was fairly common knowledge throughout the late 1700s and throughout the 1800s that America had a goddess whose name was Columbia and who was on top of the Capitol building and who was on our coins, and we've referred to her as Lady Liberty, and there were songs sung to her and poems written to her. And I remember that morning when the space shuttle went down, I got up in the morning to do my writing. It was fairly early. I went out and got the newspaper and brought it in. We were living in Vermont at the time. Brought the newspaper in and set it on the table, and Louise had made some coffee, and the paper fell open to the front page. And here is this huge headline, Columbia Dies Over Texas. And my first thought was, you know, George Bush from Texas, my first thought was, my God, George Bush has killed the goddess. I mean, it was just because that was, you know, what was in my head. And then my second, you know, and then I realized it was the space shuttle that they were talking about. You see the photo on the front page. And I thought, you know, how ironic and perhaps symbolic. This is, as I recall, this was before 9/11, that the goddess of democracy, or the space shuttle that was named after the goddess of democracy, would die over Texas. And, you know, Columbia dies over Texas. It was just a shocking headline. Anyhow, 1-866-303-2270. Anything goes Friday. Daryl in Phoenix, Arizona, listening on KPHX. Hey, Daryl.
Hello.
You are on the air, sir.
Oh, yeah. Hello, how you doing?
Just great. What's up?
Okay, let me turn off. Okay. Anything goes Friday. Good, I'm glad to hear that. The thing I'd like to say is that, you know, it is high time that we as victims of the big oil companies fight back against the exorbitant fuel prices of the big oil companies. So what I would suggest people to do is that on July 4th, for that day, boycott all gas stations. You know, fill up July 3rd, July 5th, but protest these prices by not going to any station on July 4th. And starting July 5th, begin a three-month rolling boycott, beginning first on the list is ExxonMobil, then Chevron, then Shell, then British Petroleum. And this is the only way we as consumers who are being victimized by these ever-increasing fuel prices can fight back.
Daryl, it's not going to work, and
well,
I've gotten.
Say that unless people, you know, get out there. And
No. Let me explain to you why it's not going to work, and because I've been getting these emails now for 6 or 7 years. It's sort of like a heroin addict saying, you know, I'm going to stop heroin for one day to prove to that pusher that I'm not really addicted.
Well, we're not as degraded as heroin addicts. Okay?
No, we're worse. We're killing people around the world. We're killing millions of people around the world in order to maintain our addiction.
Well, what would you propose to do to stop this?
I would propose that we.
That's the only strength we really got.
But see, we don't. I mean, Daryl, just think for a minute. I am an optimist, and I'd be glad to give you my solution if you'll let me finish
you're
a sentence here.
To fight oil by boycotting oil.
Daryl, they will laugh at you.
Well,
they're laughing at you. They're saying, oh, yeah, he's not going to buy gas on July 4th. Well, he's going to have to buy it on July 5th because he's still got his SUV.
Do you know the impact that will have if most Americans stop buying on July 4th?
None whatsoever.
And then begin a rolling boycott on
all. It'll have none whatsoever, Daryl. If you want to have impact, stop using the stuff. In other words, get a fuel-efficient car.
Boycott. Fight.
Okay, well, good luck. I'm telling you, they are, anybody, the oil companies are laughing at you. They're saying, oh, yeah, well, he'll be back tomorrow. We need substantial change.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
Before the hour, and let's see what happens when a small-time crook buys a newspaper and then buys a radio station and then buys a television station and then buys another radio station and then another television station and then another newspaper and then buys a radio network and then another radio network and then another television network, ends up owning most of the media of the entire country. And then runs for prime minister. Well, if he's Silvio Berlusconi, he wins again. 71 years old, his third term. It's all about Silvio. And as Reuters notes, he's putting the finishing touches on his cabinet. This is quite literally, this is the exact language from the article by Reuters. Silvio Berlusconi putting the finishing touches on his cabinet. The media mogul held last-minute negotiations with his main allies from the National Alliance, a party with fascist roots, and the vehemently anti-immigrant Northern League over how many cabinet posts they should have. This will be the most right-wing government since fascist dictator Benito Mussolini. Party colleague Roberto Calderoli, who as a minister in 2006 provoked bloody riots with his T-shirt with the cartoon of the Prophet Muhammad, will be in charge of slashing red tape as head of the Legislative Simplification Ministry. The Welfare Ministry is being abolished. And, quote, this government's first moves will show us whether there will be zero tolerance for the poor and full tolerance for white-collar criminals, said Antonio De Pietro, former anti-corruption magistrate. Our Berlusconi alert for the day. Fascism returns to Europe. And Stephen, who describes himself as a language person, says, Tom, I love you, but you're exactly wrong, strictly speaking. Sex is a biological term that refers to the difference between the male and the female of a given species. So apparently all those years on those forms where it said sex, and I wrote yes, or occasionally I'd write no, I should have written male. Anyhow, he says, gender is purely a grammatical term, albeit one that in the last 30 years or so has been commandeered, if you will, into service to replace the arguably more loaded word sex. As I understand it, this originated in America and has since spread somewhat in the wider English-speaking world. Interesting. Okay, Leslie in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, listening to WPTT. Hey, Leslie, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be on.
Thank you for calling.
I just wanted to call to reference the previous caller who I felt was rather rude to you. You are one of the more positive and proactive voices on talk radio today, and I thank you for that.
Thank you, Liz.
I'm calling because I wanted to refer to the gas out day he was speaking
mm-hmm.
about.
Yeah.
And I totally agree with you where one day isn't going to make a difference because, let's face it, you're buying your gasoline either the day before or the day after, and we all know that that's not a true boycott.
Right. At the end of the week, you've bought the exact same amount of gas. The only thing that's going to bring about a change with regard to these oil companies, well, there's two things. One is legislative change. Change the rules of the game. Start enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act and break up the big companies, at least here in the United States. Teddy Roosevelt broke Standard Oil up into, as I recall, 23 different companies. I mean, it's something like that. It was just amazing.
Right.
And so, number one, reinforce the Sherman Antitrust Act, which is going to require us forcing our legislators to act. And number two, use less fuel. I mean, it's very simple. You get a more fuel-efficient car, use public transportation, walk, ride a bicycle, things like that. And arguably, number three, as one of the callers to Bernie in the last hour said, let's have a Manhattan Project to develop alternative energy sources that, you know, with the funding that we're putting into Iraq right now, by this time, we could have, like Germany has done, we could have put solar panels on a third of all the houses in America.
Right on. And we all know that it would decrease pollution in our urban areas where it is so badly needed.
Yeah. Amen. Leslie, thank you very much for the call and for your kind words. Much appreciated. Thank you. Dawn in Portland, Oregon, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Dawn.
Happy Friday, Professor. How are you?
Well, thank you. Happy Friday.
Well, I'm calling about you and your friend Frank, your Indian friend. You were talking to him about how we've lost our rituals. Do you remember that?
I do, yeah. And Frank actually has died since then, but I remember him well. He is an extraordinary
Well,
guy.
You said something about how we've lost our rituals and now all we have is stuff.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, actually, we
haven't lost our rituals because we come from the school, the Cartesian school of I think, therefore I am.
Yeah.
Which splits us. It splits us into the sacred and into the profane.
Right. And it wasn't just Rene Descartes who started that. It really goes back to Aristotle and his atomistic theory.
Eric Fromm or something like that. But it's of the same school. It splits. It takes the dark, the earthy, the female, and makes it into this profane, something lower. And it takes the Cartesian, what's only in the mind is the only thing that exists. I think, therefore, I am.
Right.
And so I wanted to tell you that that's what we have. That's why we're so empty. That's why we're so disconnected from everything. Because we have this unbreakable dichotomy that nobody seems to be able to figure out a way to push us away from.
I agree. And it's interesting, you find among the mystics in Judaism, the Baal Shem Tov, the whole Hasidic movement, in Catholicism, people like Thomas Merton, some brilliant writing, Saint Francis. There are always these mystics who are reaching. I'm sorry.
That's the source of that emptiness.
No, what I'm saying is that even in the midst of that emptiness, there are in all these major religions and outside of religion, in things like, you know, Wicca and animism, which are growing, you find that there are people who are trying to reconnect with the earth, who are trying to reconnect with all life, who are saying, you know, even in classic religious traditions.
But you've got 400 years of all of this thought that says somehow that where we exist right here and in the now isn't enough. What's waiting for you in the next life is what's most important. So
That
connects into just about everything else, every other problem that we have.
I absolutely agree, Dawn. And my point is that in all of these religious traditions, and yeah, the hour is over now. Thank you for the call. And in all of these religious traditions, what you will find is that there are also people, and they're historically, and very often they're referred to as saints or prophets or, you know, wise elders, who have reached beyond that and have reached into saying, you know, this moment is sacred, life is sacred, all life is sacred. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Call 866-303-2270. The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And welcome back. $600,000? Interesting conversations going on in the chat room. You can get over there at TomHartman.com if you want to drop by. $600,000? Anyway, Jim writes in, he says, listening at work and not able to call in, he says, the John Adams miniseries on HBO got me to think of this question. When did the Federalists become Republicans and the Republicans become Democrats? Hope you can address this on today's show. And given that it's Anything Goes Friday, let me take a shot at it. First of all, in my opinion, David McCullough's book, John Adams, was, and I read it when it first came out in hardcover, 6-8 years ago, was an attempt, and there was a photograph, and actually you can Google around for these, you know, pictures of McCullough and George Herbert Walker Bush together and interviewing each other and hamming it up and whatnot, that this book was an attempt to rehabilitate the image of a guy who arguably was was a great patriot at the beginning of this country and was one of our worst presidents. But he was also the only president whose son went on to become president. And so McCullough and the Bush family, in my opinion, went off on a crusade to trash Jefferson and rehabilitate Adams. And they had to trash Jefferson because Jefferson was the founder of what is today the Democratic Party. And Adams was a Federalist at that time or throughout his life. And the Federalists morphed, you know, the Federalists basically died out in the 1820s. And the Whig Party came along, and then the Whig Party died out in the 1850s and was replaced by the modern-day Republican Party. Now, in the miniseries and in the book, the party of Jefferson, what is today known as the Democratic Party, is referred to consistently as the Republican Party. It was actually referred to very often during that time and very often in his writings. Jefferson did refer to it simply as the Republican Party, but it was also referred to as the Democratic Republican Party. During the presidency of George Washington, as these political parties were forming, there was a Democratic Party and there was a Republican Party. And Thomas Jefferson brought these two factions together and created the Democratic Republican Party. That was its official name. You won't learn that from the John Adams miniseries. And the Democratic Republican Party was its name right up through, I think it was Zachary Taylor, right over through around the late 1820s, early 1830s. And at that point, the party dropped the word Republican from its name. And they simply referred to themselves as the Democratic Party. And they are still the Democratic Party. And there never has been and there is not any such thing as a Democrat Party. That was something that Joe McCarthy started big time as a slur, basically. So when you hear somebody referring to the Democrat Party, that's just a slur. So anyhow, the Democratic Party was the Democratic Republican Party that was founded by Thomas Jefferson. They dropped the word Republican from their name in the 1830s. The modern-day Republican Party was founded in 1856, as I recall, in Jackson, Michigan. In fact, I think it was June of 1856 in Jackson, Michigan, their first big political party pulling together. And their second presidential nominee, their first serious nominee, was Abraham Lincoln. And it was a party of reform. By that time, the Democratic Party had become essentially the party of slavery and the party of entrenched power. And there was a demand for reform in the United States. The Republican Party in the 1860s became the party of reform with Lincoln. And then by the 1880s, in fact, the Republican Party's platform in the 1886 election was a major progressive and populist platform. But that was also the time when the Republican Party was undergoing the transformation of basically being bought out, as was the Democratic Party to a large extent, by the robber barons. And as we slid into the Gilded Age, and in the late 1880s, and through the 1890s, the Republican Party essentially sold out completely, stopped being the party of reform, disassociated itself from the Wobblies and the Grange movement and the whole labor and progressive movement. And although, with the single exception of bouncing back a little bit during the presidency of Theodore Roosevelt in 1901 through 1907, arguably 1908, and became the party of big business. And they've been the party of big business ever since. So I would submit to you that there has been some revisionist history, shall we say, during the administration of Bill Clinton. When you read the biographies of the various presidents on the whitehouse.gov website, it pointed out that Thomas Jefferson was the founder of the modern-day Democratic Party, that James Madison, the president that followed him and who was his protege, was a member of the Democratic-Republican Party, that James Monroe, who followed James Madison, was a member of the Democratic-Republican Party, and on through the list, you know, and then it pointed that out. Now, if you go to whitehouse.gov and you look at Thomas Jefferson's biography and James Madison's biography, or actually it's been about 6 months since I went to the whitehouse.gov website. Maybe they've fixed it, maybe they've cleaned it up since then, but I doubt it. It said, at that time, 6 months ago, last time I looked, in the biographies of the presidents, that Jefferson was a Republican, and that Madison was a Republican, and Monroe was a Republican. And these guys, you know, they were, Jefferson was the founder of what is the longest lasting political party in the history of the world, and certainly the longest lasting political party in American history, the Democratic Party. Although, as I said, it was called the Democratic Republican Party up until the late 1820s, early 1830s, when they just started dropping that phrase Republican. So anyhow, that's an answer to your question. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Justin, Woodland Hills, California, listening on K-Talk.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
I'm fine. What's up?
A couple of things. I just wanted to point out the lady who referenced the farm subsidy relief after the Columbia disaster.
Right.
Actually, the Washington Post did a 13-part series on that, and Bill Moyers about a month ago had an hour-long special on it. And what it was the Republicans actually slipped in the last bill they passed, that if there's a federal disaster declared in any county by the feds, that if you have a farm on that land, no matter what the disaster is, you are now eligible for relief, meaning they could get the subsidies for it. And, you know, I thought it was kind of...
Was this just pandering to the farm state stuff?
Pretty much, yeah. And yeah, especially in Texas, too. The local representatives in the state Congress in Texas, right, in the affected areas, and also the House members, the Republicans in Texas, actually wrote newsletters and sent out letters to the farmers where some of the debris from Columbia fell on, saying they are now eligible for this money. It was absolute pandering, and Bill Moyers did a great job of pointing it out.
This is another example of why we need public financing of our elections.
Absolutely.
There are 115 million of us who earn a paycheck, and if every one of us gave $5 a year, that's about almost $700 million a year. Over a four-year period, that's almost $2 billion. It's $1.5 billion if I'm doing... No, it's almost $3 billion,
yeah, exactly,
if I'm doing my math right. And that's certainly enough to fund an election cycle. And, it's just that's at $5. You know, if we made it $10 a person per year, it would be twice that. I mean, it would be more than all the money that's spent in politics. And why don't we fund our own elections and take it out of the hands of big farm, big agri, big corporations, big oil, big, you know, fill in the blanks. Justin, thank you for the clarification on that. I mean, it is so time for publicly funded elections. I mean, it is so time for it. Kyle in San Rafael. Hey, Kyle, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Well, since it's Anything Goes Friday, I thought I'd hit you up with a little different thing than the usual discussion. Here in San Rafael, California, we are home to Frank Lloyd Wright's only public government building. It is the Marin County Civic Center. And if you've ever seen it or seen pictures of it, it's quite the unusual building. One of the features that I've always loved about it is that Frank Lloyd Wright designed the fourth floor library to sit on top of the third floor county supervisor's office. He said he did that to symbolize that knowledge is more important than political activity.
Oh, that's interesting.
Now,
that's,
the reason I bring it up is because the building is unfortunately under siege by some short-sighted individuals who want to build four-story condos around it. The site was picked by Frank Lloyd Wright back in the 50s because of the hills, and the building bridges three hills with two beautiful arched. I mean, this thing is the equivalent of the Guggenheim Museum, in my opinion, in terms of politics.
Yeah, it's a major, it's a major both political and architectural landmark.
Well, it's also nominated for a World Heritage List sighting. And so it's an international treasure. I would like to encourage your listeners who care about Frank Lloyd Wright's heritage to speak out against the proposed project to build a four-story, massive four-story condominium across the street from this wonderful building. Can I give out the information, or should I just...
if you got a website, real quickly, we're going to hit a break here in about 15 seconds or 10 seconds.
Okay, I would urge them to listen to, or to call, area code 415-485-3095 to speak to Rafi Boloyan. He's the project planner, and I think a little pressure to him, or Mayor Al Boro, if people can Google him. I think that
Yeah, I would say go for the mayor. I wouldn't go after private individuals. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, taking back the mainstream media.
3 hours a day.
5 days a week.
Minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, powered in part by Teamsters for Change. It's time for a change in Washington, D.C. Find out more at teamster.org. And a week from today, I will be in Chicago. Do you have that information, Sean? Where am I? Oh, here it is, right here. Thank you very much. I'm sorry. I will be at the Frugal Muse Bookstore Friday, May 16th at 7 p.m. That's at 75th and Lamont Road near I-55 and 355 in Darien. You can get more information at WCPT820.com. And then, of course, on Saturday, I'll be over at the Green Festival, one of the keynote speakers on the main stage. So it should be a great time, and I'll be signing books there as well. So 1-866-303-2270, your telephone number, Chris in San Francisco. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. Thanks for waiting so long.
Yeah. Actually, I get to listen to more of your show than I normally do by being on hold so long.
Okay.
So that's been pleasant.
Make a lemonade out of lemons. I like it, Chris.
Hey, I was so thrilled this morning in your first hour segment to hear somebody call in about the Uniting American Families Act.
Yeah.
And I actually know a little bit about it, and I would love to just share some information and maybe encourage callers to contact the representatives if they're so moved.
Sure, and you may also want to go over to Bernie's site, sanders.senate.gov. He has a feedback mechanism there, because I think apparently he was not familiar with that specific piece of legislation.
And I think a bunch of politicians are not. I mean, my own senator here in San Francisco, Dianne Feinstein, I just wrote her the other day about it, and I've written her about this issue before, and I get the same response form letter back. And I think it's an issue that was introduced first, or legislation that was introduced first in 2000. Mm-hmm. And it's the House bill is 2221, and it was introduced by Representative Gerald Nadler from New York. Mm-hmm. And basically, it first came in that session of Congress as the Permanent Partners Immigration Act.
Okay.
And then it was later changed to the Uniting American Families Act. But basically, the language says to amend the Immigration Nationality Act to eliminate discrimination in the immigration laws by permitting permanent partners of U.S. citizens and lawful permanent residents to obtain lawful permanent resident status in the same manner as spouses of citizens and lawful permanent residents, and to penalize immigration fraud in connection with permanent partnerships. And, you know, the issue is that basically same-sex couples, if an American falls in love with somebody from another country and ends up entering a committed relationship, there's absolutely no way for them to justify that relationship and be able to sponsor their partner.
Yeah, in fact, we have one of our kids actually has a good friend who fell in love with a person from England, and both of them are the same sex, and they could not get their union recognized here in the United States, and so they decided to move to England.
And that's happening a lot.
They're both living there. But here's the thing that kind of makes it a tough one, and that is how do you define that without first acknowledging gay marriage, as Canada has done, as Mexico has done, as most European countries have done. I know, for example, my wife's brother's wife, my sister-in-law, is not an American citizen. She's from another country, and she's been here for 6 years, I think, so maybe longer than that. The two of them have been married. I mean, actually married, and she's still trying to become a U.S. citizen. And Louise and I have had to go down to the INS and testify that yes, in fact, you know, they really do love each other. They really are living together. They really are married. This is not one of those, you know, give me $10,000 and I'll make you a U.S. citizen kind of things.
Right.
How do you, in the absence of some legal acknowledgement, because in this case there's actually a marriage certificate and a ceremony, and it's legally recognized by the United States and by the state that it happened in, I think it was Vermont. How do you, in the absence of that, demonstrate partnership?
I mean, good question. You know, and I think that, you know, that is one of the dilemmas that comes up around the whole issue of marriage, you know, and that becomes a whole other discussion. But, you know, I think that in the end, you know, the immigration authorities have a mechanism by which they interview couples, and they have couples substantiate, you know, through joint bank accounts, through maybe leases with both their names on it.
So it's the same. It's the same
to show that they are, and they go through interviews, and they have to go through repeated interviews. And some people have it easier. Some people get stuck with an ornery agent at the DHS, and they have a really rough time with the process. But they're given the opportunity to prove their relationship and say.
So it sounds like it's the exact same process that my brother-in-law is going through right now.
Exactly. You know, and I think this legislation is being designed to sort of sidestep the issue of marriage, but say, you know, give couples who are in a committed relationship. And, you know, in the San Francisco Chronicle a couple years ago, I was surprised to see a story about a gay couple here in the Bay Area who have been, at that point, I think it was like 25 years together, with one of the partners being an illegal alien, and they're living under the radar. Yeah. And, you know, if, you know...
Chris, we've got 15 seconds here before we're going to get shut down at the bottom of the hour.
Let me encourage people to Google Uniting American Families Act. You can go to immigrationequality.org or Out for Immigration. That's OUT. Number 4, immigration.org, and find out more about this issue.
Great. Thank you so much
for taking my call.
You're welcome, Chris, and thank you so much for being an articulate and to the point spokesperson for your cause. It's a good one, and one that I support. And I would encourage everybody to let their members of Congress, whether it's the House of Representatives, your member of Congress, or both of your senators know about this. 27 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program on Anything Goes Friday. Coming up next, Rush Holt.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
4 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program here on Air America Radio. And Congressman Rush Holt is on the line with us, the congressman from New Jersey. I think the first time, sir, that we talked was almost 5 years ago. Welcome back to the program.
It's good to be with you. That's not the last time we've talked, is it, Tom?
No. Anyway, no, but that was when you were first getting into the issue of electronic voting machines.
Election voting reform, that's right.
Yeah,
well, it's good
yeah.
to be with you, always.
Thank you, and great to have you back. One of the few real scientists in Congress as well, as I recall. You just came back from Iraq, and you wanted to share with us some of your perspectives on that?
Well, you know, it's not a happy subject to talk about. I mean, it is impressive to see our soldiers. They are, you know, all of this talk about how we're having to go to greater lengths to recruit and so forth. It's not apparent to the eye, to my eye anyway. You know, the soldiers are remarkably capable. They seem well trained. I hope they're well equipped. They seem to be. And in my limited contact, I can't really comment about the morale. I met with soldiers in the general's offices, and so you know it's
yeah.
maybe not the best place to gauge the morale. But I also saw some out in the field. I wasn't on, combat maneuvers with them, but, you know, I took the Black Hawk helicopter from here to there, and I mean, here and there within Iraq. Anyway, so they are, in a sense, it's a good story to see the soldiers and to see this really marvelous assistance they get from intelligence. Real-time information, you know, if they're out on combat maneuvers, in some cases they know what's around the next corner. I mean, you know, not in just some general sense, but more specific. But it's not a happy subject to talk about when you look at the big picture and kind of examine the fundamental questions here. I was with one other member of Congress, and we spent well over an hour with General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker, just the four of us around the table.
Mm-hmm.
And they have they tell a good story. It's not just happy talk.
Mm-hmm.
General Petraeus is a very, very smart man, and he has his charts and graphs to show the progress that's being made. But there's progress only if. Only if you're willing to continually redefine success.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that's what we've done for 5 years now, just continually redefine success.
Congressman, my father was a member of the occupation forces in Japan after World War II, and told me a lot of stories about what that was like. And nobody that he knew, and to the best of my knowledge, nobody in Japan or Germany after World War II was killed by uprisings or insurgents. In large part because of the Marshall Plan and similar programs in Asia, where we helped countries rebuild themselves. It seems that if we were to put even a small fraction of as much money, and this is kind of the lesson at the end of the movie Charlie Wilson's War, even a small fraction of the amount of money that we've put into military operations, into reconstruction, we not only would no longer, would our soldiers, you know, basically have bullseyes on their backs, but we might begin to capture the minds and hearts of the people in the Middle East.
Yeah.
Isn't it time for a Marshall Plan kind of thing?
And
Iraq seems to be sitting on $50 to $80 billion of oil revenue right now, and it's not being spent for that kind of thing.
Yeah, that is part of it. General Petraeus has these charts to show that there are fewer AQI. AQI stands for the Al-Qaeda in Iraq. That's as they're known, and so it's kind of that's the measure of success or a principal measure of success. But of course, before we invaded Iraq, there were no AQI.
Right, and isn't AQI really just a way of saying these are Sunni Iraqis who at one time were, you know, barbers and bakers and candlestick makers and school teachers, and then they became insurgents, and we called them insurgents, and then they declared their allegiance to Al-Qaeda, and they became AQI, and then they became part of the awakening groups because we started paying them $50 a week to become local militias, and now they're not AQI anymore, and if we stop paying them and we still occupy their country, they're going to become AQI. I mean, isn't this just a giant semantic game?
Well, yes, and actually, in what you just said, you also would want to say that some of them are from outside the country.
Mm. But it's fewer than 10%.
Small number. So, you know, I got back last weekend, and actually later in the day, just a few hours after I got back in the U.S., I was scheduled to meet and speak to a veterans group. And I said to the veterans, many of whom were from the Second World War, I said, you wouldn't recognize this war. Not only is it high tech, and as I said, you know, the intelligence and surveillance and reconnaissance is so good in real time. Sometimes it is so good, I guess. You know, there are some major failures, too. But sometimes it is so good. The soldiers who served, you know, 60 years ago or even 10 years ago wouldn't recognize it. But the other way they wouldn't recognize this war is back then we knew what success was. You know, it was unconditional surrender of the Germans and the Japanese, and we knew who the enemy was. In Iraq, it is not clear who the enemy is, and we've redefined success so many times. Well, first it was retribution for 9/11, and then it was to stamp out Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, and then it was to topple Saddam.
We did win that war. I mean, when Bush
to stamp out Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, and then it was to kill or to depose at least Saddam Hussein, and then it was to bring all of the various factions together for an election, and then it was to stand up a democracy in the Middle East that everyone in the region could look up to, and you know, and it's been redefined and redefined. Actually, the only one of all the various defined successes that we can was actually achieved was deposing Saddam.
And that actually was the end of the war. It's been an occupation ever since then. It hasn't been a war. Congressman, I want to ask you, we only have about 2 minutes left. I want to ask you about your restoring voter confidence and having paper voting trails efforts over the years. I know you've gone through a lot of transitions, as it were, in your perspective on this. We're going to have states in the 2008 election where there is no paper trail. The election is absolutely unauditable, and the votes are being recorded in a proprietary fashion by private corporations, and we're being told, just trust us and no, you can't know what's inside this machine. Isn't this wrong?
Of course it's wrong. We've missed a number of opportunities on the federal level to get it right. Fortunately, some states have taken steps to have verifiable voting, auditable voting, and to put in place audit procedures. There's still time for some states to do it if they have the will, and maybe the voters can push things that, you know, the active citizens can push things that way. And some states already have paper-based voting, but they don't have in place audits. But at the federal level, we have failed to accomplish it. I will keep pushing.
I understand you had legislation that everybody on the committee, Republicans and Democrats, said, just fine, this is great, let's get this thing out to the floor. And then when the vote came to release it from the committee, all the Republicans voted against it?
All the Republicans from the committee who had voted for it voted against it, and almost all the Republicans in the House voted against it. This was after word came from the White House that the president didn't like it.
Why do the Republicans not want there to be a paper trail?
I can't imagine. I would think everyone would want verifiable, auditable elections.
What possible rationale do they have? I don't get it.
They say it's not necessary. They say it's expensive. You know, we are spending a lot of money to bring democracy to other places, to mention a few, Pakistan and Afghanistan and Iraq. I'm not sure how much is too much to spend for reliable democratic procedures here in the United States, but yeah, they seem to think this was too much.
This is the beating heart of democracy, to quote Thomas Paine. I mean, literally, this is our vote of all the commons that you would not want to have privatized and that you would want to have transparent. It seems our vote would be at the very top of the list because that's the means by which all the other franchises of government are exercised.
Yeah. Well, we keep trying to do whatever we can to establish standards from the national level, but so far we have failed. We might be able to get through emergency ballots so that every jurisdiction would have to provide backup ballots if the machines fail. But that's just a small piece of what we need to do. So I'll keep working on it. I know
good on you.
Your listeners have been committed citizens on this, and I appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, Congressman Rush Holt, thanks for the work you're doing, and thanks for dropping by and talking with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you. Congressman Rush Holt of New Jersey, 45 minutes past the hour. It's Anything Goes Friday. We'll be taking your calls, 866-3. Actually, I think we're gonna be hearing from Ellen Ratner at the Talk Radio News Service as well. Right after the break. It's, I believe so. Yep. TomHartmann.com, AirAmerica.com, our websites. 45 minutes past it.
The Tom Hartmann Program, the true people's radio.
Tom Hartmann.
Of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Hey, thanks so much to Louise Hartman, to my producer Sean Taylor, to Chris Rosen, Lauren Kirshner, Sean Kinsey, and Marcus Hillman at Air America. To Sue Nethercutt, the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program, and to Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, and all the folks over there at talkradionews.com. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom. Happy Friday.
Thank you. Happy Friday to you, too. And what's going on in the world today?
Well, oil just topped $126 a barrel, and people are reeling as the price of regular is $3.67. That's what they say it is. Of course, it's more than that just about everywhere you go. So I just mentioned that in passing as everybody just goes and gasps.
I'm telling you, there's some multimillionaire commodity investors who are smiling very broadly right now, and a lot of sheikhs and you know, folks in anti-democratic kingdoms and Jimmy Carter warned us about this. I mean, he's the guy who, you know, back in the day said this thing is coming. In fact, even this is Jimmy Carter in 1979.
Moreover, I will soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
Doesn't it bring tears to your eyes?
Wow.
And Reagan gets elected and takes the solar panels off the roof of the White House and shuts down all of Carter's programs. I mean, he actually got that legislation passed. We would have no energy crisis right now. We wouldn't, if Jimmy Carter's legislation had simply stood, then we would be, you know, 9/11 wouldn't have happened. We would be independent of Middle East oil. You wouldn't, I mean, it's just mind-boggling. It's just absolutely mind-boggling. The damage that's been done to this country by the Reagan administration and the corporatocracy that has followed it. But in any case, you're here to share the news of the day with us, not to.
Well, that's astonishing. Well, one thing I didn't get to yesterday, so this is a little bit old, but I think it's very interesting, is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which they're wrestling with in the House and the Senate. You've probably been talking about this. The Senate passed a bill which contained immunity for the telecom companies, and many people are up in arms about this because people feel that what they did after 9/11 was wrong in the sense that they basically violated people's privacy because of the government electronic surveillance program. Well, the telecom companies have been presenting congressional Democrats with a set of proposals on how to provide immunity to the businesses. And the Democrats are looking at this and are trying to find a way to come up with some kind of balance so that they can pass a bill. And it looks as though they are coming up with some kind of compromise. But my question is, how can you come up with a compromise? You either grant them immunity or you don't grant them immunity.
Right. Yeah, it's the bottom line. I just got a couple days ago an email from Jay Rockefeller's campaign saying, you know, he's running for re-election and he needs your support. And I'm like, oh, now I get it. You know, it's all about the campaign contributions. It's all about I thought he was not up for re-election this time. He's the Democrat who, you know, on the Intelligence Committee has been kind of leading the charge to give immunity to these corporations and to the Bush administration who colluded and collaborated with them, conspired with them, all except for Quest, which said, no, we're not going to do it. And I think that we should congratulate the telco company that said, no, they're not going to break the law. All of them have big legal departments. They certainly knew what was legal and what wasn't. And if one of them could have said, no, this isn't legal, and the other ones, if they got some sort of assurance from the Bush administration that they would not be prosecuted, let's offload this thing on the Bush administration.
It's very interesting to me how differently the Senate and the House have chosen to handle this. The House have just chosen to stand up and said, we're not doing it. And the Senate have completely caved, and they have the same information. They could have easily stood up and said, we're not doing this, but they
It takes about $6 million minimum to run for the Senate, you know, and every 6 years they've got to come up with that $1 million a year. So every day, every senator wakes up and has to figure out where they're going to get $20,000 that day. In the House of Representatives, it costs a whole lot less. And so, you know, I think that that's what's going on. Now, up at the top of Huffington Post, Barack Obama has more superdelegates now than Hillary Clinton officially. What is the echo of this in Washington, D.C.?
The echo of this is that this is the beginning of the end. I mean, we kind of had the beginning of the end after Tuesday, but this is really the beginning of the end. Now that he's overtaken her, there is officially no way, people say, that she can do anything whatsoever. She can't catch him up in pledged delegates. She was always hoping that she could do it with superdelegates. Maybe there'll be a whole rash of superdelegates who will suddenly jump up tomorrow morning and say, you know something? I'm for Hillary. But the feeling that that's going to happen is pretty slim.
About her only hope right now is that the sky falls somehow. That what's the old political cliche? The dead hooker in the trunk or the boy in the bed kind of thing, you know, that some sort of horrible scandal comes out.
A dead girl or a live boy, I think, one or the other. But, yes, that's all she can hope for. Jeremiah Wright gets out of his bed and starts spouting off something. That's all she can hope for. And the chances of it happening are pretty slim. And even that doesn't seem to be able to damage him. So she's pretty much got nothing.
Yeah, so she's going to go out. I'm assuming that she's going to just follow this thing through June, go out with a couple of victories, go out gracefully, and maybe end up as vice president. And if not, boy, I sure hope that she becomes the leader of the Senate, because I would love to see somebody instead of Harry Reid taking names and kicking ass. And she has certainly demonstrated she can do it.
Ted Kennedy is saying that she won't be the VP.
Well, if she's not, then I would love to start a grassroots campaign to make her the leader of the United States Senate, the majority leader of the Senate, because, you know, Harry Reid should have been standing up to the Republicans these last 2 years and should have been absolutely raising hell and should have been saying, okay, you guys want a filibuster, I'll play political chicken with you and back you down. And I think that Hillary Clinton would do that, and he hasn't. So, you know, I think that, you know, she has a tremendous political future regardless of what happens.
As long as she's gracious.
Yes, as long as this plays out in a fairly clean and diplomatic fashion, shall we say.
Exactly. Yeah.
Victoria Jones, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Always great talking with you. Coming up Monday, Carrie Lucas, the Independent Women's Forum. We're going to be talking about homeowner bailouts and the government programs. And what was that about Bear Stearns? Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Tag, you're it. We'll see you on Monday.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.